What we don't know about cell phone radiation could really be hurting us.
There's a lot that scientists do not know about cell phone radiation and cancer, cell phone radiation and genetic damage, cell phone radiation and miscarriages. But the evidence, as we say in the article in The Nation, the evidence is abundant, and much of it is tending in the direction of saying that there is a problem here.
That's investigative journalist Mark Hertzgard. He tells us about the explosive new report he co-wrote with Mark Dowie, how big wireless made us think that cell phones are safe. That's coming up in the second half of our show today. But first, April is Poetry Month.
And this is where I live, here, where everything lives in the eye and ear, and a silky frenzy steeps the wetlands in testimony, in praise, where the meaning calls of osprey ricochet between the loquacious silence of the dunes and the cleansing sweep of moonlight, where the souls of the dispersed dead pass, making and remaking their silhouettes, one luminous lost imagination at a time.
That's Philip Schultz. We talk with him about his latest poetry collection, Luxury. Later this month, we'll air our interview with poet Catherine Levy about her latest collection, Reports. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. My guest Philip Schultz's poetry is deceptively simple. His poems often minutely observe the details of everyday life, but those become the vehicle to deeper concerns, such as mortality, shame, and self-sabotage. Yet they're lightened by his ever-present wry humor. Using humor, irony, and celebration as ballast against the book's darker forces, his new collection, Luxury, explores the comfort and sustenance of life, the bittersweet clarity of aging, and the anxieties of existence. Tony Hoagland said of Philip Schultz that he's one of the least affected of American poets and one of the fiercest. Schultz lives in East Hampton, New York, and is the founder and director of the Writer's Studio in New York City. Well, Philip Schultz, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back.
I just loved this new poetry volume, Luxury. The title poem, Luxury, I'd like to talk about a little bit later, that really takes up almost half of the book. But first, just to say that in a general sense, the theme of mortality seems ever-present. You write that the end is taking me somewhere the beginning never wanted me to be. Talk about the sense of mortality that infuses the work of this book. And I have to say, it's not a glum book by any means. It's quite inspiring.
Well, you know, that line, I couldn't end that poem. This is from the Westerns, right? It's yeah. I remember not being able to know where that poem was going. I'm remembering back in being a boy in Rochester, New York, and all my friends were basically first-generation immigrant kids in the inner city, and we'd Saturday morning go to the RKO and sit in the balcony. And it was going back to my beginning and remembering trying to look forward. But I couldn't end the poem, and I had an idea what it was about. And out of absolute frustration, ready to give up on it, I ended up almost hating it, as I do many, because I don't know where it's taking me. I start by wanting to be the boss, the director, and then I realize it's just the opposite. In order to go anywhere worthwhile, I'm the one being led. I'm the follower. And then that line appeared. And I remember how odd it made me feel. So in a way, I was in the same place you are in asking that. I recognized that it was genuine. It was felt. It was heartfelt. And that it made sense in the context of the poem. But I wasn't entirely comfortable in saying that out loud. you know, I mean, on the surface, it's sensible that when we start out, we're young, we're always going to be young. Everything is always ahead of us. And suddenly, one day, there's more behind than there is ahead. Mm-hmm. And it takes us by surprise. And I didn't know I felt that way. And I didn't know the poem was going there or to some extent about that. That the Westerns were such a large part of my youth, watching that, the romance with the American rhapsody, I call it, the American ideal, was somehow tarnished in some way. That I reached a point where it wasn't an ideal. So, I mean, that is where the line came from. It's sometimes, if you push hard enough, what you find, what you come to, is what you've been feeling all along but haven't yet realized. And that is a dark line, in a way.
A dark line?
Well, yes. The idea of not realizing one's mortality or what it is. I remember one friend, I show my work to some friends, and they return the favor. But commenting on that line, not being sure if he liked that line. And I did, and it made sense, and others did. But I understood he's older than I am, and I think he was taking that even more seriously than it does make you ask yourself that question, doesn't it?
Exactly. There's also not just an awareness of, you know, where you began and where you may go, but also an awareness of the fragility of the future, not just personally, but in general, I felt in this cycle of poems. I mean, I'm sure a lot of us have been thinking about, you know, the situation we're in as a society, and the future does seem very fragile to us. And it seems there was some of that in this book.
Well, when you're going through a dark time, it forces you to take a lot into, you know, to keep one eye on the road behind, on the rearview mirror. You're looking, you're trying to get somewhere, and you're driving to extend that metaphor, but you're also interested in where you're coming from and what's behind you. In my sense, I have two sons. I have two young men with their world ahead of them, their lives ahead of them. Mm-hmm. And it makes me feel particularly vulnerable because of this political situation and having someone out of control in the White House who represents everything negative and conceited, vainglorious. And that, I mean, it's one thing for myself, but it's another thing for them. I mean, if he can affect their future. And there's a kind of helplessness involved. I mean, how much control do I have over that? Very little.
You also have a wonderful poem about the links between immigrants, past and present. The poem is Greed, and I loved it. I wonder if you might be willing to read that for us.
Sure. Greed. My ocean town struggles to pick up leaves, offer summer school, and keep our library open. Every day now, more men stand at the railroad station, waiting to be chosen for work. Because it's thought the Hispanics will work for less, they get picked first, while the whites and blacks avoid each other's eyes. Our handyman, Santos, who expects only what his hands earn, is proud of his half acre in Guatemala, where he plans to retire. His desire to proceed with dignity is admirable, but he knows that now no one retires. Everyone works harder. My father imagined a life more satisfying than the one he managed to lead. He didn't see himself as uneducated, thwarted, or bitter, but soon to be rich. Being rich was his right, he believed. Happiness, I used to think, was a necessary illusion. Now I think it's just precious moments of relief, like dreams of Guatemala. Sometimes at night in winter, surrounded by the significant silence of empty mansions, which once were cottages where people lived their lives and are now owned by banks and the absent rich, I like to stand at my window looking for a TV's futile flickering, always surprised to see, instead, the quaint, porous face of my reflection, immersed in darkness, its one abundance.
And one of the things I really like about your poetry is that poem starts, you know, very prosaically in the real sense of the term, you know, like prose, but the rhythm of it gathers, and it, as it goes deeper, it starts on a very kind of quotidian level and ends on a very introspective level.
Right. And again, that surprised me, that ending. You know, in winter out here, we're surrounded by darkness. I mean, mostly houses that no one lives in, or they come in the summer or the occasional weekend or holidays. But you can't even see a light in a window. And all around, you look up and down the street, you see maybe 8 houses away on the left side, you see a light. But it's kind of isolated. And it's a strange feeling at night. Because we live here. This is our home. But a lot of people, their summer homes.
And we should say we're really in the heart of the town, of the village of East Hampton.
Yes.
Here. It should be a place where all the houses are occupied all the time.
Well, when I first moved here in 1990, you know, people did live here. And this was one family, and he was the town postmaster, the town mailman, for all his life. So this is a two-family house. And he died here, and his name was Schott. It's close to Schultz, Schott. The house was built in 1927. And it's interesting. It was a different neighborhood then. They were all cottages. This was a cottage we added on as our family grew, the whole half of the house. But now they knocked down all these cottages and they built McMansions that go to within 10 feet on either side of the property line, and no yards, and they're empty. Some of them are unsold, some of them are bought and they're going to be sold, or some of them people just live in a few months a year.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Philip Schultz about his latest poetry collection, Luxury. And yet there's another aspect of this place, its beauty, which you just, with stunning imagery, express in this wonderful collection of poems, Luxury. For example, I love the imagery on page 31 in which you say that everything lives in the eye and the ear. Maybe let's take a look at that poem.
Well, that's
too.
That's the title poem, right? Yes. Oh, no, that's the Welcome to the Springs.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. The poem is an elegy for a very good friend of mine who was a poet and an art critic and the literary editor of the East Hampton Star. I'll read the last part of the poem. Okay. What role did I play that last? He died of cancer. What role did I play that last night? Watching you high on morphine, drop cigarettes into your lap, swooning inside a cancer and cold train, stained oblivion. What can I do, you asked. There's nothing I can do. Well, what didn't you do? Chauffeuring James Brown from Harlem to Montauk, high on Librium, you got from a Chelsea speed freak, cooking your manic bouillabaisse stuff with half the Atlantic Ocean, spoon dancing Getz and Bud Powell, swollen with vodka and dreams of Venice, your dinner riffs to Li Po, Machado, and Blake. How I liked your stories of you, a gay teenager, wandering among your MoMA pals, Goya, Rauschenberg, and Francis Bacon, learning to hide inside art's ecstatic parentheses. In any case, it's March, warm and wet and windy, And this is where I live, here, where everything lives in the eye and ear, and a silky frenzy steeps the wetlands in testimony, in praise, where the meaning calls of osprey ricochet between the loquacious silence of the dunes and the cleansing sweep of moonlight, where the souls of the dispersed dead pass, making and remaking their silhouettes, one luminous lost imagination at a time.
That's so beautiful.
It took 10 years to write this poem.
Say more about that.
It's a somewhat complicated story. I didn't write poetry for over 15 years, and there were 18 years between books. When I met Monica, I started again. We moved out here, and I was happy not writing, but suddenly, you know, I was in love, and there was a wedding, and I started writing poetry, and I met Robert he ran the reading series at Guildhall and the other things, and he was my first poetry friend in 18 years.
Robert
Long, a wonderful poet and a cook and a jazz aficionado. And he wrote a wonderful book called The Kooning's Bicycle, which is about the art history of the East End. I mean, he really knew everything. Anyway, he was a very good friend. And I forgot the original. What was the question?
Why did it take you so many years to write this poem?
Well, I would show him my poetry. He would show me his. And I was showing him Failure, the long poem in Failure, which is my most successful book. And
that's an irony.
Yeah, I know. Failure, my most successful book called Failure. And out of nowhere, he died. He was like a couple weeks before 52, very young, unexpected, cancer. And I realized that I didn't know what the poem was about, and I kept writing it, and it didn't work. And it got longer and shorter, and it didn't work. And his grave is around the corner from me. It's buried in a Catholic cemetery around the corner. And every now and then, since he really introduced me to East End, he grew up here. He was friends with Lisa de Kooning and part of that whole scene. And I was, in many ways, new. So he would show me shortcuts and tell me about the history of this place, and all that was important. And in many ways, all the stuff that I'm writing about, East Hampton and all of that, is like proof that I finally belong here, that I live here. Because he said that he liked my work, but I wasn't yet writing about East Hampton, and he wanted me to. And one day I was visiting his grave and just catching him up, I realized I started cursing him and being angry. And I was shocked. Realized how angry I was that he had died. He broke this contract. We were helping each other reemerge as poets. He had stopped writing, I had, and he broke the contract. And I didn't. I think how it works psychologically is that I was so guilty about being angry at a friend dying that I buried it. And when I buried it, I couldn't write the poem. So off and on for 10 years, I tried to write this poem. I hated the poem. It was this huge struggle. But as soon as I realized the anger, the line in the poem that deals with it is, Monica's new sculpture has grown darker, as you said it would. Eli is happy at Amherst, and Augie likes to write. What a surprise. Well, I've forgiven you, finally, for not living to see the book you helped me write get published. Only now do I understand that. It's not the resentment I regret. It's the shame. So once I realized that, I came home and wrote it quickly. You can't write a poem until you really know the truth about how you feel and can connect to it. And if you're ashamed or guilty about how you're feeling, you repress it. So there's no poem. And I had lived with this guilt for being angry at him for dying for 10 years. So it was a hard poem to write.
And so much of your work, you know, you said your most successful book was Failure. And the last time we spoke with you, the title of that book was The God of Loneliness.
Everybody, by the way, except for my wife, told me not to call the book Failure. No one is going to buy a book called Failure.
And yet they did. And, well, I mean, I think, you know, it's like connected to what you just said before. You can't write a poem until you know what it's about, until you really understand, until you can speak in a true voice. And so many people do read, I mean, people read poetry to uncover that truthful voice. And we all deal with failure and shame and loneliness.
Right. I mean, that's exactly true. I think when you, that's what you want to find when you go to your poetry. I was reading Lorca. There's a new wonderful translation, and I was just reading all his early poems, especially like the Gypsy Ballads and the poem, the Spanish poems, not the New York poems. And God, it was just a fountain of feeling and enthusiasm and love of music and all of that. I think when you go to poetry, you want to be opened up. You want to know what you're really feeling, what's your experience. Sometimes we experience things in a delayed way because unless we know how we're feeling about it, we don't possess what just happened. You write poetry to possess it, to own it. And people go read it for the same reason.
To own and possess the feeling.
Yes. Or the experience of something. I mean, sometimes automatically people just repress death, you know, loss. It's too painful and you survive it by burying it. And yet you know something's wrong and unfair about burying something too deeply.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Philip Schultz, poet Philip Schultz, about his most recent collection of poetry. It's called Luxury. And Luxury is now, let's talk about Luxury. It is the title poem. It also makes up about half of the book, and it really focuses on the theme of suicide. So tell us a little bit about what moved you to write this very long poem.
Well, I turned 70, and my wife and sons took me on a trip to, they arranged a trip to Cuba, and a place I very much always wanted to visit. And when we were there, I made a thing about wanting to visit Hemingway's house, and we did, and it was quite something. It's so fragile, they don't let you inside. You just have to peer through the windows at all the rooms and everything, because it can't take people, hordes of people passing through. And I was just terribly moved. At one point, I remember my wife saying to me, I never looked happier. And I, since I was a boy, I loved Hemingway's work. And Hemingway died, killed himself, less than a year before my father's died. He died of a heart attack. But in my 17-year-old mind, he was a suicide because his doctor called me into his office and said, your father is working himself to death. He had a stroke, and if he doesn't stop working and go into a hospital, he's going to die soon.
And what was your answer to the doctor?
We don't get along. I mean, it was the last thing. It's quite a responsibility to give a 17-year-old. And he said, he won't listen to me or your mother. Only you could save him now. So in my mind, and I didn't realize this until I wrote this poem, that I was supposed to save my father's life and didn't, failed at it. And that was the first failure. And then I had other friends, another very dear friend who ended up killing himself. And my job was to try to save him also. So it took me a long time. I came back from Cuba and I started to write what I thought was a short poem about visiting Hemingway's house. I have other poems about other Hemingway houses. And out of that came the understanding that I had linked in my 17-year-old mind Hemingway's death with my father's, and then I was writing about my friend Ralph. And that led to Paul Celan, another suicide.
And tell us who he was.
Paul Celan was a great Holocaust poet, the greatest of all of them, the way Primo Levi was a great nonfiction, fiction writer of it. But Paul Celan was a great who lived with it as long as he could. And I was introduced to Paul Celan by this friend, Ralph, in graduate school. He had just translated his most famous poem, Death Fugue, in Daedalus, a very prestigious magazine. And he was being shown off by the director and the heads of the program. It was my first year and his second. And a fuss was being made. And I, of course, was attracted to that. And we became friends. And he introduced me. He was half black, biracial, white mother, black father. And it was interesting because he introduced me to all the Jewish poets. I'm Jewish. He wanted to be a Jewish man of letters, a Jewish intellectual. Isaac Babel, Yehuda Amichai, who became a close friend, Mendelstam, all these, and Paul Celan, and which was kind of ironic. And I had grown up in an inner city. And there were many blacks living neighbors and people I identified with. So I felt at home with him and he felt at home with me. We became best friends for many years. And he had a darkness in him that I and others tried to spare him from, and it didn't work.
Yeah, and you pleaded with your friend, who you call R in Luxury. You pleaded with him to, you say, assent to Rhapsody. What did he tell you in response?
Well, there was a conversation, and in the last conversation we had, he told me that I was always encouraging him to write, that I figured that writing for me was a form of salvation, and it should be for him too. And he was an incredibly gifted poet and musician. And sometimes in San Francisco, he would call up late, play something, and then hang up without saying hello or goodbye. And that was him. And he wrote music and all of that. So in this last conversation, I said, "Are you writing?" And he said, "No." And I asked why. And he said, "Because every time he tried to write, a black bird would appear on his shoulder and tell him." He called it a bird. Tell him that he was worthless and that anything he would write would be worthless. It was useless. And then he said, on the other shoulder, he heard my voice telling him that he's gifted and that he should write and all of that. And he then told me that the bird had won. It's too persuasive. I tried to plead with him to listen, and he basically said he didn't call to be saved. He called to say goodbye. I didn't realize any of this until I was writing all of this, and it felt like the last piece of the puzzle, putting it all together. I have a school of writing called the Writer Studio, and I guess I'm in, you know, it helps people. That's really what the purpose is. And one of the things we teach is that everyone has a shitbird, a negative force that is a negative voice, that if you go to a party, if you give a reading and the place is full, you only look at the ones who didn't come and get upset. The glass is always half empty. If you should rejoice, if there's something nice happens and you instead get depressed, it's your shitbird's voice. Everyone has one. And helping my students identify theirs helps them write, because then they can push it away. Its argument is always, they don't know, you can't do it, and it'll go, what's the sense of all of this? Because it won't go. Or they write something fantastic and they can't send it out, mm-hmm. because then they're afraid that somebody will publish it and that something bad will happen, that recognition will bring something that they're ashamed of something. They're ashamed of the feelings, and maybe they've written about their mother or their father or their girlfriend, and maybe they'll see it, whatever. But I actually didn't realize it, but the school I created, a crazy idea. I mean, I left a paying job, a good with benefits, to do something where I didn't make a dime for several years, and because I had to. And one of the things I was always talking about was a shit bird. So if you get what I'm saying, it's been a linear line.
That's poet Philip Schultz talking about his latest poetry collection, Luxury. There's much more to that interview. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest. Next, Big Wireless's disinformation campaign about the health dangers of cell phone radiation. We talk with Mark Hertzgard about the special investigation he did with Mark Dowie for The Nation magazine, how Big Wireless made us think cell phones are safe. Stay tuned after the break.
Love it is a wounded bird, quiet whisper I have heard, a letter written with no words, read by crazy faith. A fiddle with a broken string, a song with only angels sings, a church bell that may never ring, except by crazy faith. I lit my love and watched it burn, asking nothing in return, except the lessons I would learn by holding crazy faith. Now I'm touched by that brightened fire, down to the root of my desire. Now the smoke, it rises higher on crazy faith.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We originally planned to air our interview with poet Catherine Levy today, but we've rescheduled that interview for 2 weeks from now. That's because of an explosive report that appeared recently in The Nation magazine by my guest Mark Hertzgard. We think it's so important, we wanted to make sure to air it as soon as possible. That's because it's about the serious dangers emerging about a device that 95% of us carry everywhere and use all the time, our cell phones. Actually, there have been indications of the dangers of cell phone radiation for decades. But as Hertzgard and his co-author Mark Dowie show in their report, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe, those findings have been minimized, mocked, and muffled by the wireless industry. Following the script of Big Tobacco and Big Oil, Big Wireless has carried on a campaign of denial to protect their bottom line while putting consumers, and especially kids, at risk. Mark Hertzgard is The Nation magazine's investigative editor at large and the author of 7 books, including Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, which we spoke to him about in 2011. Mark Hertzgard, thanks so much for joining us here.
Sure.
Now, your article that you co-wrote with Mark Dowie, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe, your angle on this article is really on how the cell phone industry has tried to game the system to prevent independent research about cell phone safety from getting to the public. But before we get to it, I'd like to ask you, what do we know about cell phone safety?
The latest news development on this story actually came the night before we released our article in The Nation magazine. And I'm talking about how on March 28, the U.S. National Toxicology Program, which is part of the National Institutes of Health of the federal government, they had done one of the biggest studies on cell phone radiation and health to date. And that study was being peer-reviewed by a panel of independent outside scientists, which is normal procedure. And those outside scientists concluded that there was, quote, clear evidence, unquote, that cell phone radiation can cause cancer. Clear evidence. And that was a particular kind of cancer of the heart tissue And they also found some evidence, which is the second ranking in confidence behind clear evidence, some evidence that it also causes cancer in the brain and the adrenal glands. That's the most recent finding. But we did find in our article for The Nation magazine that the picture that the American public has of this science is very different from what the actual picture is. And, you know, as an illustration of that, there has been zero mainstream news coverage of that National Toxicology Program peer review on March 28. Zero, even though it says that cell phones can cause cancer. So when we looked at the database of studies on this issue that are maintained by the National Institutes of Health, I shouldn't say we looked, but we talked to a scientist, Henry Lai, who is a professor of bioengineering emeritus at the University of Washington, who's done a lot of work in this field. And he went through and looked at all roughly 200 studies there and found that the vast majority of them indicate that there are health effects. Now, the science is not definitive. I want to be clear about that. The science is not definitive yet. There's a lot that scientists do not know about cell phone radiation and cancer, cell phone radiation and genetic damage, cell phone radiation and miscarriages. But the evidence, as we say in the article in The Nation, the evidence is abundant, and much of it is tending in the direction of saying that there is a problem here. That is definitively not the message that the cell phone industry and the mainstream media have been giving us for the last 25 years. And that's because of the propaganda campaign on the part of the wireless industry that we describe in our article.
And before we get to that, what is the mechanism of harm?
That's something that scientists are still not clear about, exactly how this happens. They don't quite understand it, and that's part of the reason that the science isn't definitive yet. However, it is thought that the cancerous mechanism is indirect, that it has something to do with weakening the blood-brain barrier. That is the barrier that keeps many of the toxic chemicals that are in the rest of our body from getting into the brain. But as I say, there's a lot more work that needs to be done here. And just because we don't understand the exact mechanism by which something happens, it doesn't mean that it's not happening. Scientists had the same problem with cigarette smoking back in the 50s, and it delayed their understanding. And for many years, they were saying, oh, cigarettes cannot cause cancer because we don't understand how that could happen. And it turned out, of course, that cigarette smoking does cause cancer.
Now, this is a lot, as you point out, of like what happened earlier with big tobacco and big oil and the fossil fuel industry. You say that the industry doesn't have to win the scientific argument about safety. It only has to keep the argument going.
What's striking is how the wireless industry used the very same playbook that big oil and big tobacco used previously to lie to the American people about their own products and the health risks thereof. So big tobacco was told by its own scientists in the 1960s that smoking cigarettes is dangerous, can cause lung cancer and heart disease. What did they do? They kept that information to themselves and publicly told the world, no problem. Same with big oil. They were told by their own scientists in the 1980s that if we keep burning fossil fuels and emitting them into the atmosphere, we're going to catastrophically destabilize the climate on this planet. What did big oil do? They kept that information to themselves and in public insisted that the situation was quite the opposite, that there was too much uncertainty in climate science to know if there was any real danger. And that's exactly what we document about the wireless industry doing the very same thing. In the 1990s, the wireless industry was told by its own scientists privately that there were quote unquote serious questions about whether cell phone radiation caused cancer, genetic damage, etc., especially among children. What did the wireless industry do? They kept that information to themselves while publicly saying there was absolutely no reason for consumers to have any concern about this. Then they wargame the science, they fund friendly science, and attack critical or independent science. And by doing that, wargaming the science, they make it appear that there is more disagreement among scientists than there actually is. And that's where they don't have to win the scientific argument. Industry just has to keep the scientific argument going, or appearing to keep going. That's exactly what they did with climate change again, that to make it look like there was more disagreement among scientists than not. And so it's a very striking example of how big corporations and multinational industries, they learn from each other. They study what works when other industries get in trouble, and they adopt those very same tactics. But think about this the next time you go and buy your cell phone, that the companies who are making this were told 20 years ago that cell phone radiation might give kids cancer, and they went ahead and did it anyway.
Yeah, talk about why kids are more vulnerable.
Kids are more vulnerable to cell phone radiation for two reasons, essentially. One is that they're younger, and so their lifetime cumulative exposure figures to be greater. A second reason, though, is that their skulls are smaller and their skulls are still growing. And so they absorb, their skulls absorb much more radiation than an adult's would. Nevertheless, the Federal Communications Commission, which is the regulatory agency in the United States for cell phones, their standards for the amount of radiation a cell phone can emit, their standards assume that the average consumer is a 200-pound man. And therefore, the amount that is allowed is much greater than you would advise for a kid, which is why in Britain, in France, in Israel, and other countries, the governments have issued strong recommendations, if not rules and limitations, on how much children should be using cell phones, which is very little.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Mark Hertzgard about the report he co-authored with Mark Dowie, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe. Another aspect of how these companies are able to operate in this climate of doubt is that there is regulatory capture. And you say that the FCC is a captured agency.
We quote a report by Norm Alster at the Harvard Center for Ethics called Captured. And he goes through and does a very detailed examination of the Federal Communications Commission and shows how it is indeed a captured agency. That is, an agency that has been captured by the industry it is charged with regulating. And one of the ways you see that is the interchangeability of personnel between the agency, the federal agency, the FCC in this case, and the industry, the wireless industry. And the best example of that is Thomas Wheeler. Thomas Wheeler was the head of the cell phone industry's trade association in Washington throughout the 1990s. And then he later became the head of the FCC under President Obama. And you can find many, many examples of this. Norm Alster in that Harvard report also quotes the cell phone industry praising the FCC for, quote, its light regulatory touch, unquote. And that light regulatory touch is exemplified by the fact that the FCC does not independently test the amount of radiation levels of these various cell phones. The manufacturers are required to report those levels to the government, and the FCC posts them on its website, but the FCC allows the industry to basically self-regulate on that and does not even do independent testing of the amount of radiation, which is a very simple thing to do.
So, Mark Hertzgard, also talk about the WHO, the World Health Organization. They classified cell phone radiation as a possible human carcinogen. Why not probable when others did? And tell us what the distinction between possible and probable means in regulatory terms.
Sure. The World Health Organization is arguably the world's premier entity on these matters. It's part of the United Nations. It's got a long and illustrious history. And it began to look into cell phone radiation in about 2010. There was a study called Interphone. And then they pulled together scientists from around the world in a meeting in 2011 in Lyon, France. And at that meeting is where they made this decision to list cell phone radiation as a possible carcinogen. There are four levels of ratings inside of the WHO on cancer-causing materials. There is the top one, which is category one. That's a known carcinogen. Category 2A is a probable carcinogen. Category 2B is a possible carcinogen. And then below that is basically unknown. And that's where, prior to the 2011 meeting, cell phone radiation was unknown. And so the question going into that meeting of the WHO is, well, will they leave it at unknown or will they give it a formulation? And this is where the wargaming of science by industry became very important, because the industry managed to get a number of its paid scientists onto the advisory board of that meeting and to attend that meeting as observers. So they could kibitz, they could complain, they could talk to fellow scientists in the evenings and basically lobby them one way or the other. As it turned out, there was one scientist there, a Swedish scientist by the name of Lennart Hardell, who had done some of the most powerful research on this question that was considered there at the 2011 meeting. And he was pushing for a category one, that this is a known carcinogen. The industry was able to push back against that and prevent that. And they even prevented a ranking of a probable carcinogen. But the group as a whole did agree to possible carcinogen. And so that's an example of how, did the industry like that? I doubt it very much. But part of what you're doing with a propaganda campaign is damage control. And they did not like possible, but they liked possible, a ranking of possible, a lot more than they would have liked probable or known, the level that Hardell wanted to go to. And so that's a very telling example in our article in The Nation magazine of just how the industry influence operating behind the scenes was able to get into that meeting. And part of the way that they did that was to basically embroider the truth about their corporate ties. A number of those scientists, you know, you're not supposed to be taking money from corporations if you're serving on one of those scientific advisory groups. And so one of the scientists that we write about, Niels Kuster from Switzerland, he had to actually adapt his conflict of interest statement to the WHO to show that, oh, yes, he did actually consult and take money from a number of different corporations. Nevertheless, he was allowed to participate in the entire 10 days of the deliberations.
In the title of your article for The Nation, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe, a subtitle is The Disinformation Campaign and Massive Radiation Increase Behind the 5G Rollout. So this is truly terrifying. Tell us about the 5G rollout and what does it mean for our health?
5G refers to the fifth generation of cell phone technology. And it is the technology that is, when you hear people talk about the Internet of Things and how your smartphone will connect to your smart house and your smart house to your smart vehicle, so that when you're leaving the office, your phone can basically connect back to the house and say, turn on the oven to 350 degrees and turn on the heat so that the house is warm when I get there and I can start cooking my dinner right away. That's the Internet of Things. And it is seen by the industry and by its government patrons as a massive new economic bonanza that will lead to literally trillions of dollars, they say, trillions of dollars of additional economic activity around the world, in fact. And there's a big argument that, oh, the U.S. has got to get out in front of this. We can't let this key technology be dominated by China, et cetera, et cetera. But there is a catch to 5G, which is that it will involve far more radiation and far more cell towers. But they will be tiny cell towers, about the size of a pizza box, but they will be every 250 feet along city streets and suburban neighborhoods. Every 250 feet, there will have to be one of these 5G transmitters. Why is that? That's because the radiation that 5G uses, the radio waves, are different, and they cannot travel as far through space. So in order for there to be full connectivity, you have to have cell phone towers, mini towers, every 250 feet. And as a result of that, and they'll be on 24/7, obviously, as a result of that, they will be we quote a scientist from University of California, Berkeley, saying that because of that, everyone, the whole general population, whether you have a smartphone or not, we will be bathed in a radioactive smog 24/7, and which is why the petition that you reference, that we cite in our article, signed by hundreds of scientists around the world, who published 2,000 peer-reviewed articles, they warn about this. They say this will lead to massively increased radiation levels for the general population. And the last point to understand about 5G is that this has not been independently safety tested by the government. We're making the very same mistake in that case with 5G that we made with cell phones originally. The original sin of cell phones, and why we got into all of this with the industry lying about the science, is that cell phones were allowed onto the U.S. consumer market in the 1980s without any government independent safety testing. And it wasn't until 10 years later, when some consumers who were being diagnosed with brain cancer said that they were blaming their phones and suing the companies, that's when the cell phone industry said, oh, okay, well, we're going to do our own scientific research and we'll show you that cell phones are safe. Well, by then, you know, science was going to take a backseat to profit. That's exactly what we've seen for the last 25 years. And we're about to repeat that mistake with 5G. Now, it doesn't have to happen. It's not a fait accompli. And there are a number of states, for example, I live in California, where our governor has reiterated that the local governments have authority to decide whether to allow 5G pizza box cell phones to be sited or not. I believe something like that is under consideration in New York State as well. The industry, for its part, is suing and demanding that federal standards prevail and that they be allowed to put up these pizza box transmitters every 250 feet. So this is a live issue right now moving forward, and it's one that I think that your listeners might want to pay attention to and talk to their own local journalists and local public officials about how to respond to this.
The Internet of Things already exists, so is 5G even necessary?
5G is necessary if you want to take it to the entire Internet of Things, where it is not just sort of a marginal presence, but is the dominant way that we communicate in the society. Yes, is it necessary? No, I would argue that it is not necessary for our society. But the vision that the industry and the government have for this, and there's a lot of, you know, to be fair, they say, well, you know, this is going to change things like police response times and ambulances getting out to rural areas. There's a lot of great things if we can you know, get all these devices talking to one another 24/7. Well, that's possible, I suppose, but at what price?
Right. Not to speak of the total surveillance that implies.
Well, that's a whole other aspect of this, the surveillance, and we haven't talked about the addictiveness of this either. You know, this is an addictive technology. And again, like big tobacco, big wireless deliberately has sought to addict its customers. In the case of tobacco, they did it by putting nicotine into the cigarettes. In the case of big wireless, they've done it by giving you little dopamine jolts. The likes that you get from Facebook or Twitter, little dopamine jolt to your brain that keep you coming back. Sean Parker, one of the founding presidents and executives at Facebook, admitted this last November that basically that's how we spent our time. How do we keep you to give us as much of your time and attention as possible? Well, we got to give you a little dopamine jolt every once in a while. So this is a highly addictive technology. It's especially addicting, I think, among children. I mean, you walk outside of any middle school or high school now at the end of the day, and kids are staring down at that screen. They're not running off and playing. They're not gossiping with one another. All of their life seems to be mediated through the screen. And that is not healthy. We are certainly spending a lot more time with these devices than is good for us.
Do you use a landline then? What do you do to minimize your exposure?
I use a landline when I can. at all times. And when I have to use a cell phone, I have earbuds and I keep the conversations as brief as possible. And the other thing is to make sure that you hold that phone, even if you've got earbuds on, hold it the maximum distance from your body that you can, because these waves travel only a very, short distance. So you want to limit your exposure that way. And in particular, at the moment of connection, that's when there is the biggest zzz, of the two phones connecting. That's when it's very important not to have that phone next to your ear.
Absolutely. Well, Mark Hertzgard, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here. The article you co-wrote with Mark Dowie is The Big Wireless, How Big Wireless Made Us Think That Cell Phones Are Safe. And this has just been a terrific and terrifying conversation.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Mark Hertzgard. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to Hertzgard's piece. You'll also find a link to our 2011 interview with him about his book, Hot. Well, we have a little time left. Let's hear a clip from our forthcoming interview with poet Catherine Levy as she reads her poem, In the Garden. Poet Catherine Levy. We'll be airing our full interview with her in 2 weeks from today.
In the Garden. The wild butterflies in the garden that can never meet for more than a second. And even then, the belief that you're crashing, locked in a lover's arms, he will protect you. You will die together. And he turns away and falls to sleep. My lost friend said, we are never alone. He locked his door. He hid behind his books, dreaming of me. As I sit here still dreaming of him, and the words he almost spoke. An imagined friend rocks me to sleep in a tower too high for the world to reach, too high to breathe or speak or caress, but I keep longing for flesh, those frantic nights, pressing my lover never closely enough, pushed onward by the fact of our love. We are deeply, deeply alone.
Right. I mean, it's really a poem about intimacy and aloneness. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about that juxtaposition.
Well, the thing that I love about writing poetry is in the process of writing the poem, you discover what you need to say. You haven't determined it beforehand. And I think that when you read poems by people who have determined it beforehand, the poetry feels dead. So I didn't know where I was going with this poem. The poem is an act of discovery.
Poet Catherine Levy. We'll be airing our full interview with her in 2 weeks from today. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.